Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Christine Ahn, founder of Women Cross DMZ, who discusses the letter sent by her group to President Trump, calling on him to initiate regional peace talks with North Korea. Matthew Gardner of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who talks about why he believes the Trump tax reform plan is a revival of voodoo economics. And Aaron Greenberg of Union Local 33 Unite Here, who explains why 8 graduate students launched a hunger strike on April 25th to pressure Yale University to start union contract talks. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On April 26th, several hundred South Koreans protested the deployment of a U.S. missile defense system known as THAAD, or Thermal High Altitude Area Defense, which is designed to shoot down short and medium-range missiles launched from North Korea. Local Korean farmers fear electromagnetic waves from the radar could threaten crops and public health, as well as making their community a target in a future conflict. The rapid deployment of the THAAD system amid rising tensions with Pyongyang drew opposition from the leading candidate for president in South Korea's May 9th election. Beijing also condemned the missile system as China views THAAD as a security threat. Last year, the United States and South Korea agreed to deploy the missile defense system, but the timetable was moved up before the May 9th presidential election, where the leading candidates have pledged to seek improved relations with North Korea. According to the Guardian newspaper, the deployment involved 6 launchers, special intercept missiles, and a radar system which theoretically can strike incoming missiles in mid-flight. Indigenous Guatemalan farmer and land reform activist Rodrigo Tote has won the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize for his years of campaigning to win land titles for Native communities in a long-running dispute with international mining companies and the Guatemalan government. With renewed interest in nickel mining a decade ago, the Quechua people, who are descendants of the ancient Maya, were at risk of being forcibly removed from their homes near Lake Isabel by mining companies in violation of international treaties. Tote began gathering evidence of indigenous land ownership 15 years ago and along the way discovered pages from the official land registry had been removed in an attempt to deny land rights to the indigenous community. In 2011, Guatemala's Constitutional Court recognized the land rights of the Quechua and ordered the government to issue titles, but the government has never complied. Tote has received many death threats, and one of his sons was murdered in what appeared to be a staged robbery. Another son suffered serious injuries. Over the last year, 2 Goldman Award winners from Latin America have been killed, including Honduran activist Berta Cáceres. The British campaign group Global Witness says over 570 environmentalists have been killed in Latin America since 2010. Like many former slave plantation counties, Jefferson County, Mississippi is divided into 2 distinct classes, a land-owning elite that is both black and white, and a large impoverished majority that is almost entirely African American. Fayette is the only incorporated town in Jefferson County, which is the 16th poorest in America. Its unemployment rate is the second highest in the state. But it defies the stereotype of rural poverty in at least one important respect. Of the 3,143 counties in the United States, Jefferson County has the highest percentage of citizens who are African Americans, 85% as of 2013. According to the news magazine In These Times, most residents in poor Mississippi Delta communities have 3 choices: leave town, get a minimum wage job, or turn to off-the-books work. Today, 56% of African-American residents in Jefferson County live in poverty, as opposed to 1% of white residents. In the corporate media, black poverty is usually depicted as an urban issue, focusing on cities like Detroit, Chicago, or Baltimore. Yet growing numbers of African Americans now live in suburbs and exurbs, and blacks living in rural areas suffer from a poverty rate twice as high as whites. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
President Trump once again heightened tensions in the Korean Peninsula when, in an interview on April 27th, he stated that there is a chance that we could end up having a major conflict with North Korea over its nuclear weapons and missile program. But the billionaire reality TV star also said he wanted to peacefully resolve the crisis while not taking any military option off the table. Just a few days later, however, on May 1st, in his now familiar erratic style, the president said he would meet with North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, provided the circumstances were right. Mr. Trump's conditional offer to meet North Korea's leader came shortly after his nation experienced another failure in the test firing of a missile on April 29th, the second such failure since Pyongyang celebrated the 105th birthday of its founder, Kim Il-sung, on April 15th. Meanwhile, the U.S. has deployed a missile defense system in South Korea known as THAAD, or Thermal High Altitude Area Defense, designed to shoot down short and medium-range missiles launched from North Korea. But both China and the leading presidential candidate running in South Korea's May 9th election have expressed opposition to the missile system. Your reporter spoke with Christine An, founder and international coordinator of the group Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. Here she discusses her group's letter calling on President Trump to initiate a regional peace process with North Korea, South Korea, and China.
I think that the dangerous brinkmanship between the U.S. and North Korea has existed for some time. And so I think the question has to be asked, why now? What is different? Because North Korea, as we know, conducted two nuclear weapons tests just last year alone. And they haven't done so yet this year. So what makes this situation different? And obviously, we have a new U.S. president. He unfortunately inherited from the Obama administration a really bad policy, which is what they call the strategic patience, which included economic sanctions and the military exercises, the aggressive posturing, and as we later learned, a cyber warfare program against the DPRK. But I think that's certainly one of the reasons, because North Korea, for each missile test or nuclear weapons test, they're obviously perfecting their ability to put a nuclear warhead that could potentially reach the west coast of the United States. Now, they haven't quite reached that capacity, and so I think there is that urgency coming from the Trump administration. But I think that there's another factor that's at play, and that is South Korea. There is going to be a snap election on May 9th next week in South Korea, and the leading candidate is a liberal candidate. He used to be the chief of staff under the last liberal administration in the mid-2000s, and he has said that we need to engage with North Korea, that that is the best security to defend against North Korea is actually diplomacy and talks, and that he would visit Pyongyang before he visits Washington, D.C. And so I think that part of that brinkmanship on the U.S. side, it actually can influence the elections in South Korea. And so for some time, the more conservative candidate, Ahn Cheol-soo, was actually leading in the polls against Moon Jae-in, because so much of South Korean politics is dictated by this unresolved conflict.
The United States, as I understand it, has made a precondition for talks with North Korea that they must get rid of their nuclear weapons stockpile before talks can begin. For North Korea, as they view it, that's a non-starter. What can be done at this point to try and break the logjam here, to have some kind of breakthrough for meaningful negotiations that could result in ending the official state of war between North and South Korea and de-escalate this ratcheting up of tensions?
I know, I agree with you. It's a non-starter. And basically, that was the Obama administration's strategic patience. They said no talks unless there is a clear commitment to denuclearization. In fact, they set a very high standard, you know, the verifiable denuclearization. And, you know, my hope is that the Trump administration seriously consider the proposal that we included in our letter to the Trump administration, which is right now when there is this very tense state of brinkmanship, that the costs of miscalculation are quite high. And so if we could actually agree from both sides to actually the way that the Chinese frame it is suspension for suspension, where North Korea agrees to stop its nuclear weapons program and its long-range missiles, and the U.S. either agree to reduce its military exercises or completely cancel them for a period of time, but that would basically lower down the tension so that they could actually even begin to talk. I think when we look at the voices, you know, who are putting proposals on the table, I think Bill Perry, who is the former Secretary of Defense under the Clinton administration, who negotiated successfully the freeze of North Korea's nuclear weapons program, his point is we need to deal with North Korea not as we wish them to be, but as they are. And right now, we keep saying we're not going to recognize that they are nuclear power. But the reality is they are. They already have up to enough nuclear fissile material for 20 atomic bombs. And so I think our goal is to try to stop them from advancing their long-range missile capacity that could strike the United States and to freeze their nuclear weapons program. I do think that that's a possibility. North Korea has indicated that they would. But I do think that it's a serious consideration to do the suspension for suspension and begin some kind of bilateral talk.
That was Christine Ahn, founder and international coordinator of the group Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. Learn more about the work of Women Cross DMZ by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 26th, just a few days short of President Trump's 100th day in office, a so-called tax reform plan was released by the White House that consisted of bullet points on a single printed page. Although there were few details on implementation and the net impact on families and federal revenue, it was clear that the tax plan would disproportionately benefit the wealthiest Americans, like Trump himself, and the billionaire and millionaire members of his cabinet. As his tax plan was rolled out, Trump boasted that this would be the largest tax cut in U.S. history, even larger than that signed into law by Ronald Reagan in 1981. Overall, the plan proposes a massive reduction in taxes for the nation's richest individuals, including a drop in the top individual tax rate from 39.6% to 35%, repeal of the estate tax and the alternative minimum tax, designed to ensure that the wealthiest pay their fair share, and elimination of the tax linked to the Affordable Care Act for those individuals making over $200,000 annually. Importantly, the plan also proposes to reduce the top corporate tax rate to 15% from the current 35%, although Trump and his advisors maintain that the tax cuts would pay for themselves by promoting economic growth. History has shown that the so-called trickle-down economic theory has never worked, leading many economists to predict that Trump's tax plan would add as much as $7 trillion in debt over the next 10 years. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Gardner, a senior fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who explains why his group views Trump's tax plan as a revival of voodoo economics.
There are a lot more blanks in this plan than there are specifics, but I guess the shortest way to describe it is to say that the Trump administration has been very specific about the easy part of tax reform, how far they're going to cut the rates down to 35% on the individual side and an incredibly low 15% on the corporate side. They're going to repeal the estate tax. They're going to repeal the high-income Medicaid tax that's part of Obamacare. They're going to repeal the alternative minimum tax, which tries to make sure that the best-off Americans pay their fair share. What they won't say is how they're going to pay for a lot of this. And so based on a very preliminary estimate of what's been specified, we think this amounts to a very large tax cut on the order of $7 trillion plus over the next decade, and one that will lavish almost half of its benefits on the very best off 1% of Americans.
The justification for this kind of tax plan that would disproportionately benefit the wealthiest Americans is that, and we know this from back in the Reagan era, it was pitched as a way to get to economic growth, and the deficits would disappear because this tax plan through the growth would pay for itself. Matthew, can you explain to our listeners the track record of this so-called trickle-down theory that has been a real standard part of the Republican agenda for decades now? What do we know about the veracity of trickle-down economics?
Well, a lot of economists and a lot of other people have tried to tell a compelling story about how tax rates drive economic growth. And as you mentioned, the Reagan tax cut and experiment of 1981 is sort of the pioneer in that. But no one has ever shown any relationship at all between cutting taxes and economic growth. And there's a pretty good reason for that historically, a couple actually. One is that, you know, we all know upon reflection that taxes aren't levied for the sake of having tax revenue. They're there because taxes provide the services that make civilization. And what that means is, in a deficit-funded environment, which is, of course, what we've had for the last 40-odd years on and off, anytime you cut taxes by $1 billion or $1 trillion, that's $1 billion that has to be paid for. It could be paid for by hiking other taxes. That's a lot of what happened after Reagan's 1981 tax cuts, for example. It could be paid for by cutting spending across the board in a way that no one wants to see. Either of those situations where the other shoe falls after your original tax cut is actually going to hurt the economy taken on its own.
Well, Matthew, just time for one more question here. And I wondered if you tell our audience about your views on the link between U.S. tax policy, U.S. federal tax policy, and growing income inequality in this country. And then a second part of that question would be, what would be a simple way to explain how our tax policy could be shifted to reverse that many decade-long trend to really push this inequality pattern in a different direction?
What's happened in the last 30 years is that there's been an erosion in the fairness of our tax system. It used to be substantially more progressive. We've seen cuts in the estate tax. We've seen major cuts in the capital gains tax. Top income tax rates have gone down and up again. There are now tax breaks for dividends. There are tax breaks for all sorts of corporate activities, investing in manufacturing and fossil fuels and alternative fuels, all of which have basically cut in half the yield of the corporate tax, which is generally thought to be the most progressive, one of the most progressive taxes out there. The result is that we've seen a gradual shift in the tax load away from the best off Americans and onto middle and low income Americans. What's happening when you do that is that you're actually redistributing income away from the poor towards the rich. Just absolutely the converse of what you hear with these claims of socialism. Through that lens, the remedy is pretty clear. Let's preserve the estate tax, not cut it. Let's get rid of capital gains tax breaks. Let's make sure that capital gains are taxed the same way as wages, as Warren Buffett has been arguing for years. Let's make sure that the corporate tax loopholes are gone, that all corporate income is treated the same way. These are, of course, exactly the opposite things, all of them, as what Trump is proposing. In fact, he said nothing about closing corporate loopholes, hasn't named a single one, wants to repeal the estate tax, is doing nothing to remedy the gaps in capital gains, and would sharply reduce taxes on the best off. So it's important to be clear. The Trump tax plan, as we understand it right now, would be redistributive. It would redistribute income away from the poorest 99% towards the top 1%.
That was Matthew Gardner, a senior fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Find links to more analysis and commentary on the proposed Trump tax plan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.com. www.thepacificcoast.org. In February of this year, after an almost 30-year struggle, graduate student teachers at Yale University won a union election in 8 departments. The vote was monitored by the National Labor Relations Board. Yale's administration has fiercely opposed unionization, taking the position that these doctoral students who teach undergraduates are students and not employees, and that a union would interfere with the mentoring relationship that grad students have with their senior faculty. The union members belong to Local 33 of Unite Here, which is also the parent union of thousands of other employees at Yale. Despite this victory, the administration has still refused to begin the collective bargaining process that would lead to a contract, stating that such negotiations are premature because Yale is appealing the decision. After years of employing all sorts of tactics, strikes, marches, petition drives, and more, 8 union members began an open-ended water-only fast on April 25th to pressure the university to come to the bargaining table. The fasters have set up a dome structure on a plaza outside the president's office, where they rest and greet friends and supporters, which have included the area's congresswoman and one of Connecticut's U.S. senators. Yale's administration has said the structure must be removed, but has not yet taken steps to do so. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Aaron Greenberg, chair of Union Local 33, on the 7th day of his fast. Here, Greenberg, a doctoral candidate in political science, talks about the long-running battle for unionization and his hopes for moving Yale to negotiate through this unconventional direct action tactic.
We're fasting because in February we won union elections, but the university administration has refused to negotiate with us. They've told us to wait. They've told us that negotiating would be premature. So we're waiting without eating. Their plan is to wait and to delay and to abuse the legal process so that Donald Trump can appoint anti-labor judges to the National Labor Relations Board, where they have an active appeal, and where Donald Trump and Donald Trump's anti-labor judges can overturn our right to organize. We think that's unacceptable.
Who decided that a fast would be the next step? And if you could describe a little bit the process by which you came to that decision.
Yeah, so right now it's me and 7 of my colleagues who were on this indefinite fast, colleagues from departments all over the university. After winning our elections, it became clear, unfortunately, that the administration was going to stall. We submitted over 12,000 letters from members of the New Haven community, the Yale community, elected officials, clergy, calling on the university to sit down and negotiate with us. We set a negotiating deadline for April 12th. We showed up. They were not here. In the past, we have tried everything, demonstrations, petitions, pickets, rallies, nothing has worked. So we decided we need to take a next step to draw attention to what the university is doing. What's powerful about our hunger fast is that it's ongoing. It's as ongoing as the university's legal delays. The university is paying anti-labor attorneys thousands of dollars a day to challenge our rights as workers in court. This is a very powerful way to show, okay, we're going to wait, but we're going to wait this way. We're going to wait without eating. We're going to wait in a very public, but also a very beautiful and peaceful way that is visible to the entire university community and visible to President Salove and top members of the Yale administration, who can see that members of the Yale community are willing to go without food indefinitely until we sit down to negotiate.
It's extreme, and I guess you feel like this is an extreme situation. So what kind of support have you gotten, or feedback of any kind, positive or negative, within the Yale community, within the New Haven community, and maybe at other institutions, at other, you know, universities?
In some ways, it's not that we've been waiting a few months, it's that we've been waiting 25 or 30 years. This campaign has been one of the longest ongoing unionization drives in American history, and at every point, the university administration has fought us, has tried to stall, has tried to delay, has said no, and we're tired of waiting. The support that we've gotten from the New Haven community, from clergy, from our colleagues, from faculty, has been overwhelming. And it's just been so powerful. I think many people feel that, especially after we've won our elections, secret ballot elections, supervised by the federal government, the gold standard in labor relations, it's only right that the employer begin negotiating. To be clear, we're not asking for contracts tomorrow or next week. We're asking to start the conversation and to start that in good faith. And instead, the university administration, President Salovey personally, I want to emphasize, top members of the administration personally, members of the Yale Corporation personally, are deciding, essentially decide with Donald Trump over members of their own community. Our elections were certified by the Regional National Labor Relations Board. The only thing standing between us and negotiating with them is that the university administration is pursuing an appeal that challenges the whole basis of our right to organize. The legal issues are the universities. They could withdraw that appeal and negotiate tomorrow. So it's specious, duplicitous, and shameful for the university to claim there are outstanding legal issues. There are none. The outstanding legal issues are theirs. They're the outstanding legal issues of their anti-labor, anti-worker law firm. And we urge the administration to drop their appeal and begin negotiating in good faith.
That was Aaron Greenberg, chair of Local 33 Unite Here, speaking about the water-only fast that eight union members began on April 25th. For more information on the hunger strike and the unionization campaign at Yale, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXOJ in Northampton, Massachusetts, WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.